Hey, TSL fam, producer Jeff here, and I am so excited to present an amazing best of episode for you this week as we prepare to return from our summer hiatus. Thank you to our intern Boris, who cut this episode together. He chose seven of his favorite moments from our show in the last, half a year, and kind of unified them by specific considerations, themes, and even exercises that we can be using to really dig into and find the heart of our stories. So today we hear from Alex Kurtzman and Jenny Lumet, Michael Waldron. We hear from Maggie Cohn, who showran The Staircase. We talk about character polls, Pat Verducci shows up, and even Allison Mann, who kind of helps us connect our professional careers to our personal brand as a writer. So it's a really wonderful episode. I encourage all of you to really take it in, and as always, keep writing.
You know, there's an old adage about musicals, right, where the musicals that, if you look at the structure of a musical, if you were to pull the songs out, the story wouldn't work anymore. And I think the same rule applies to action screenwriting, which is that if the set piece isn't moving the story forward or the character forward in some significant way, then it needs to not be there. And I've worked with directors before where they have pre-planned a set piece and suddenly you find yourself as a screenwriter trying to write to a set piece rather than letting the set piece grow out of, a legitimate emotional turning point for a character. And what happens is you can have great eye candy, but it's ultimately extremely empty for the audience. It just doesn't land. It doesn't stay with you, right? It's like it's candy, right? It can taste very sweet, but you don't really remember it a second later, And in my experience with set pieces now, I think they all have to tell, they either have to turn over a new card in terms of story, or they have to turn over a new card in terms of a reveal about a character in the core, or it brings two characters closer together for some reason, because like they might've hated each other, but suddenly they have to do something to survive together. And so a new bond of trust is formed in that moment. I mean, you wrote Inside Out, right? Like you could break Inside Out down with all the same rules where you have all these set pieces, but every single set piece is moving the story forward in some significant way, or it's so funny that we're having this podcast right now, because my son's 16 years old, and he reminded me last night, I'm not an easy crier. It's hard. I feel a lot of things and I promise you I'm crying inside, but to go outside and cry, like, very hard for me, except for when Bing Bong died. When Bing Bong died, I was like inconsolable. Like I couldn't, hold it together in the theater with my son. So I feel like, that's actually a great example of the answer to your question, because she has to let that part of herself go in order to move on, right? At that point in the story. And so now you have a set piece that makes you feel all of the things, but if you didn't have that set piece, the character would not get to a new place. And so I think that's sort of the standard that we use now for what is the set piece doing. It's like, does it have to be there to move the story forward?
I love that. And, we're very lucky when you are a writer at Pixar, because you have these amazing genius artists drawing. Mm-hmm. And when you have Ronnie Del Carmen creating that moment, truly, it's you're kind of following their lead. They are the leaders of that.
It's a symbiotic relationship too, because I'm sure that what happened was like you might have had something maybe half baked in your mind, or you were stewing on something, and then you see this picture that just brings it to life for you, and you probably instantly felt something in seeing it, and then suddenly the scene became clearer, I would imagine. Mm-hmm. I've been in that situation before. It's like, God, this is really tricky conceptually. Like I feel something here and I know that I kind of need it, but what's it actually going to look like? And then you see an artist hands you a rendering and you go, oh my God. And it just opens a door in your mind.
Mm-hmm. I will say though, if I could hop in, I mean, I'll just be honest, Jenny, like I love Rachel Getting Married very much. And when I think about like the scene where Anne Hathaway finally confesses her big traumatic secret in rehab, like that's totally a set piece, right? Even though it's like a small character moment, what it does in the movie compared to the stakes of what the film is and what the genre is, like when you're watching that movie, your heart breaks and you weep and you fall over. So it feels like set piece maybe is just like big emotional turning point to a certain extent.
I Though I battle being reflexively supportive, I'm going to absolutely support you in that statement. Because I also feel like when Annie got up to, and there's a big chunk of Rachel Getting Married where people are dancing and there's no dialogue. And I feel like that's a set piece. And then Annie gets up to dance and Deborah Winger does not. And I feel like that tells you everything that you need to. And she, and Deborah Winger, indeed wraps her scarf sort of even tighter around herself. And Annie gets up and tries. She can't really get into the action, but she tries. And that was certainly a set piece in that movie. So I'm with you that it doesn't necessarily have to be action or music oriented. It can certainly be emotional, and everything hangs on it.
Yeah, that's the goal, right? That it's all of those things. For your director and features, it's the climax that he's never been able to see on screen, and it's big enough, right, for this movie that you still have to hit that as a writer too, and yet it's emotional. And yeah, there's a lot of boxes to check. All that layering that goes into one of these, especially bigger projects, but I think in any project, be that TV or a small indie film, it doesn't matter. Always there's this layering in storytelling that has to happen. And that's my big drum that I beat, which is why you're doing so many drafts. Like, I think a lot of emerging writers have this idea, Michael, that you, as this big professional experienced writer, sit down and you write one draft and there's all the 10 layers. And if they can't do that, they're not really writers. And it's just like,
Yeah, I mean, there must be 200 drafts of this script that I worked on. And yeah, to everything you were just saying, what I learned, especially in the process, you learn so much watching a movie with the audience for the first time. This is my first time watching something in a theater, watching the audience react to it and everything. And you see those big scenes that felt so important, with where I really layered metaphors on top of exposition, on top of whatever, that seemed so important to me. Maybe they fall a little bit flat, because what the audience really is there for is character. That's right. And it's simple. The movie, you're so much better off if you can just start simply, because that's what you're going to end up whittling it down to, either in ensuing drafts on set or eventually butchering it in the edit. I feel like you'll end up trying to find the simplest story. I saw the new Top Gun a couple of nights ago, and I love the first Top Gun. It's one of my favorite movies, and the new one is tremendous, and it's just such a simple character story.
Talk about that a little bit. When you say whittling it on all down to character, which I 100%, 1,000% agree, and it's how I build. But now, you're talking about Marvel, Loki, or Marvel, which is just so much. There's so many things going on. So what is that process of, do you have a process to get it back down to the character?
Well, it's trying to understand it before you go in. So it feels like you got a really strong core, or a really strong foundation that you're building around. With Loki, I knew from the beginning that this was a story about his search for identity, and ultimately a journey of him forgiving himself, and a story of self-love. And with Strange and Wanda, it's a totally different thing. It's Strange kind of, it's Wanda reckoning with her grief in a different way, and in her pursuit of her children. And with Strange, it's him confronting the notion that maybe the way he does things isn't the path to happiness and fulfillment for him. And so it's like, I just try to understand, like, what are those very simple character journeys? What's the simple, something James Ponsel, a buddy of mine said to me once, the writer director, what's the love story in this movie or in this story, you know, in this show? Not mean necessarily a romantic love story, but just between two characters or a character in the what is that central relationship? And just trying to find all of that before you start figuring out what are the rules of the multiverse, because you want the plot, at least to me, to bend to the will of the character stuff and not the other way around. Because ultimately it will. When you're on set, you'll be standing there with the actors, and if it's plot driven and not character driven, everybody's gonna suss that out, and you're just gonna find yourself rewriting in a frenzy, and you're gonna end up with something that kind of sucks. So you want trying to start simply.
So how do you do that? How do you, what's your process of figuring out what it's about before you go in, right? I tend to figure out what it's about. Like, I just start writing, right?
I think it's about this, and then on draft two, I'm like, shit, no, it's about this. And
draft three,
I mean, like are you still processing through writing, or do you do it all in cards or?
No. I guess that's the next day's everything I just said. I immediately throw out the door because I'm terrible at outlining. I don't do note cards, and I really can only discover it on the page through dialogue. So it's like, I just have to have like a sense in my head of something emotional, something that moves me that can pull me through the pages. And then hopefully at the end of that, you're like, okay, maybe it's this. And then you're shaping that thing. It just needs to be at the forefront, whatever it's really about.
That when people talk about what's the concept of your show,
mm-hmm.
they're not asking you to say we're basing it on a true life event about this guy and this happened and that happened and nobody knows, did he do it or not? No, they're asking for this deeper thinking. What is your approach? What are you interested in? What are you going to center this show on? And what you guys have chosen to center the show on is so rich and so such an interesting, unanswerable in the best kind of narrative way question, right? Like that it's such a great driver and so complex, and yet you're pulling it off. I love that as the center of a show. I just think it's fantastic.
And I think it's worth emphasizing that, like, while I'm articulating it here, hopefully with some degree of professionalism, it takes a long time to figure out the way to communicate your idea that it makes it like almost edible. Like but I will say it's very helpful whether you're communicating with an executive at a studio or, you know, ultimately with the viewer. It's also really helpful when you're producing something and you're on set, because a lot of the decisions that you're making real time, you can go in a multiple directions. And if you know what the thesis of your show is or what you're trying to create, like what's the point? Why are you doing it? That can help divine out which is the best approach. And when you're tired and you're stressed and you're facing, you know, a variety of questions, if you don't have that, it just makes it more difficult. And so I kind of wanted to, you know, because for me to be like, well, you know, what's the point of being able to just, I mean, it's one thing to be able to like spout off like a log line or something like that. But if you know what something's fundamentally about, it actually will help you make it later on.
Absolutely. And I also think that that thesis, what a wonderful word to use, that thesis, I also hear you saying it's not like you wrote your first draft and there it was. And it was, you could articulate it in two sentences. Like I keep telling people, like, that's why you write so many drafts, because sometimes you just have an impulse or you just love something, but you don't know why. And it takes drafts. Sometimes it takes talking over with your friends, be that Lorian for me or my manager, where they're starting to reflect back in questions. But it's so important. I guess I just want to say it's so important to go for that, right? Mm-hmm. Like sometimes writers, pros and emerging, get so excited about the content, the larger plot stuff,
right?
That we lose this, and that this is the money. This is the gold underneath that you got to go for.
And it helps you determine what plot is most important, because again, you know, the other thing that you're doing, especially I think when you're show running, because you're, you know, producing over the very extended time period. And when it comes to limited series, it's almost as though you're making 8 movies, especially one when it's happening in different time frames. So the costumes are different. The set locations have to be different, even if they existed before. And so what it helps is you always have to lose something. Like, you're never going to somehow magically be on schedule and under budget. Actually, I'd love to hear someone's story about that, because I've yet to see it. And I certainly have a lot to learn about it. So the point being is, then you have to lose scenes. And that means you have to lose some plot. And so then again, it's like, what scenes are fundamental to expressing this thesis? Like, you don't want to lose anything, and you want to have as much to play with in the editing suite as you possibly can, but that's just not the way the world works. And so when you have to start cutting things and you have to start making that decision, if you have that thing to fall back on and you can test the scene against that, the idea of what you want to create, the scenes, if all else is equal between them, one of them might more explicitly communicate to that idea. And as such, it kind of makes that one worth protecting, you know, worth spending the money on that location, you know, worth spending more time on that scene. And then the other one kind of, you know, cross your fingers and hope that the cut isn't too deep.
You can feel it watching the show that you guys were doing that. You can feel that. Yeah. So I always say character polls. What I mean by that is, sometimes for me, it's very helpful at some point in the process. Now, I might have this before a puke draft. I might not. I might think I have it and then realize halfway through the puke draft, I do not. But what I mean by it is, it's super simple. Where does your character start and where did they finish? So when my husband once was working, he's a screenwriter and a filmmaker, and he was once working with Harrison Ford, and this was very clearly what Harrison Ford was wanting. Where do I start and where do I finish? And all as an actor play in between. And I worked many, many years with Jodie Foster, and she would always need this. Where do I start and where do I finish? I'll play in between, but that's my sandbox, right? So where do I start? Where do I finish? That is a simple saying for features, but super complex in terms of what was contained inside of there. So I just try to think of them as the poles that are kind of holding up the circus tent. Do you know what I mean? Like, and it also helps you know right towards something, or realize halfway through, oh, those aren't the poles. It just gives me some sort of context. And I have found, even with studio executives and producers, actors absolutely need it. They absolutely have to have it. But even studio executives and producers, when they say what's their arc, this is what they're asking for. They start here, they finish here. So intellectually, you can talk about that, of course, but really what I'm talking about and what they're talking about is emotionally, where is the character? So that might be a transformation. That might be a claiming, like I talk about, which is they're actually just claiming who they are. They've been right all along, but they didn't know the how of it. They knew what it was, but they didn't know how. So the easiest one for me to think about is Moana, right? Like, she's right. She does need to go sailing. Her I want song makes sense, but her how is wrong. She thinks she has to go get this guy and he has to do it, but in fact she has to do it, right? So that her house switches, and she has very, you know, at the beginning she's questioning herself, and at the end she's going to go be the hero, right? So those are big shifts. The bigger the shift, the bigger those poles, the easier it is to write. I'm just telling you right now, like, if your poles are like 2 degrees across next to each other, I'm not saying don't do that, it's just, no, it's harder, it's much higher math. So do it. But if you're really just looking to learn it and give yourself a break, put those poles really far apart as you can, right? So from good to bad, bad to good, whatever. We can talk about transformations and what those are in a second. But so when I talk about a character pole, I'm really talking about emotional moments in Act 1 and in Act 3 that clarify that arc, that transformation, that character shift, right? And usually what's really interesting is, not all the time, but often they're mirror moments to each other. Even in how the director is directing the scene, how the characters that are involved, right? So you can look at, and I have a clip that I show during my seminar of The Godfather, where he brings Diane Keaton to this wedding and he explains to her who his family is. and that they're murderers. They're criminals and murderers. And then he looks at her, and it's a bright scene, and we're lots of people, and he and his sister's up there with her husband that just got married. And he looks at Diane Keaton and he says, "That's my family, Kate. That's not me." Now, at the end of the movie, we're in a dark room with dark paneling. His face is in shadow half the time. It's in half light, half shadow. She's standing there trembling, looking at him. You can hear a woman wailing. Well, the woman that's wailing is his sister, because he has killed the groom. And now she looks at him and says, "Did you do it?" And it's a great scene. You should go watch it. He literally says, "Don't ask me about my business. Don't ask me about my business." So this very open guy who was very, very generous and wanted to be intimate with her and was bringing her in like as his best self is now looking at his best self and saying, "Don't ask me any questions. I will not participate with you." He's completely changed. He's a totally different person. And she just says, and he says, "Okay, this one time, I'll let you ask about my business one time." And she says, "Did you do it?" And he lies and he says, "No." And then he hugs her and she goes and says, "I guess we both need a drink." And she goes and gets a drink. And then she watches as the men walk up and kiss his ring and call him his father's name, Don Corleone. Right? So there's the pull. I'm not my father. I am my father. That's why the last image is him being his father. And then they close the door on her face. They literally close the door. Like, you're not allowed in anymore. He's bringing her in. And now he's closing the door on her face because he's become his father. It's the way it's so beautiful. It's one is bright and open and wide, and one is closed down and shut down and you're not coming in. And so they're beautiful pulls that once you kind of, and you might take drafts and drafts to really get them. Once you get them, it really, really helps you know where you're going. And those pull moments in Act One and Act Three, they contain the theme, that character transformation, usually the main relationship is involved, whatever that relationship. Diane Keaton happens to be, in my opinion, the heart relationship, like the relationship that he is trying to win and that he ultimately loses because he gives it up. The goal and desire of that main character is answered or not answered, right? That's my parent. That's my father, Kate. That's not me. Guess what? That's not true. And it doesn't, he becomes his dad. His want and his need, right, is all inside of those things. And when you can, like I said, when you watch these pull moments, if you're looking for them in movies, the director's using them, the setting, the production design, the cinematography, the costumes, the acting, you know, when you're watching that moment with him and The Godfather, I swear to God, after she asked him the question, you can see that boy he was flicker across his face. It's like this last moment, and then it submerges and he's gone. And he's just a different guy. So the actors love to know these pulls and how they're moving. What are they changing? You know, so I'm talking about those transformations can be big, you know, from You know, what's great about, The Godfather, of course, it's a reverse, right? It's from conscious to unconscious. Usually your character's unconscious moving to consciousness, but some movies like The Godfather flip it, right? So it can be a liar or a delusional person moving to truth. It can be revenge to forgiveness. Like these are big, big pots and words you can use for yourself to try to start to find those poles. You know, in Godfather's case, it's awareness to unconsciousness, going dark, so to speak. So that's what I mean by polls. And I can post some examples on the Facebook page that I have. And these are not genre based. I have found them in thrillers. I have found them in comedies. I have, you know, because they're character based. That it's about what, how is your character moving? How does Act Two take you from the first character moment to the last? That's what Act Two is getting them there. That's, I have my first act, I have my third act. How the hell are we going to get her there?
How do you help somebody take in what people are saying and not let it blow them out?
Yeah, that is such a great question. And like I said, I fall victim to it too, because I'm kind of a people pleaser. So I just think that I have to do every single note because, you know, so what I suggest to the writers that I work with is that, you know, sometimes when you get feedback, like you said, Lorianne, it's just like overwhelming and there's little things and there's big things and, you know, all different kinds of things. And like you said, it's like a bullet, you know, just piercing your soft writer body, you know? And, you know, what I suggest is, you know, some people like to take notes when they're, when they were having the call, you know, and they just write stuff down. But what I suggest that they do is like, just to take a couple of days and like not write anything down and just not, just let it percolate in an unconscious way. Like, I love that you took a walk because, you know, by sort of being in your body, you're allowing the notes to kind of be embodied in you, you know, as you're walking and as you're thinking. And so I always say like, take a couple of days and then write down the notes that you remember that make your body feel good. Like, my body feels like, yes, this is going to make my script 1,000 times better, you know? And then the other stuff, you know, save that for later and then think about it. Like, does that note, you know, really serve my vision? Why am I bumping on that note? You know, I know you guys have talked about this on the podcast before. It's like, what's the note underneath the note? Are they just giving me an idea that sounds really weird and is like, I just don't understand it. And like, what are they trying to solve for me? You know, but I always think like there's those higher notes that you're just, your body feels good when you process them and you're like, yes, I'm going to do those notes. And so I just always suggest to do those first.
Thank you. That's amazing. Thank you. Very validating.
Have you ever just within that ballpark there, have you ever come up against blind spots in somebody that you're working with? Because sometimes it might percolate in your body, but you do actually have a blind spot to it. How do you handle blind spots in your client?
Yeah. So tell me your definition of blind spot.
You know, the brain isn't quite ready yet to even face what you're saying. I don't even mean about craft. It might be about the character or, you know, I worked with a young man when I taught at a college grad school and, you know, he just didn't want to, I kept saying this character needs to confront his big brother about this. He can't just go out the window. Like the whole narrative is driving to this confrontation. It doesn't feel satisfying. But there was a blind spot in that he wasn't ready to have that confrontation. Or blind spots can be about larger issues of not knowing the craft, I guess, right? If you don't know how to write a big action movie and you're trying to write one, you could have blind spots about how they work. So I guess there's different kinds of blind spots. I'm thinking about this as we talk. So you can tell me what you consider a blind spot. I mean, you work with far more people than I do.
Yeah. Oh, that's great. Okay. So yeah, I love that you broke that down into kind of two different types. Like there's an emotional blind spot and then there's like a craft blind spot. You know, I'll start with craft because that's a little bit easier to kind of deal with, you know. So just taking your example of, you know, someone who's wanting to write an action movie and, you know, there are certain conventions that go with that genre of movie, you know. And so, you know, if those elements aren't in the script in some form, you know, either as a reference to it or, you know, embraced, you know, we would talk through kind of like, what are the movies that they loved, you know, and then I might go off and watch one of those movies and go, okay, so that movie that you love has these kinds of scenes. How can we sort of mine those kinds of scenes for your film, you know, whether it's based on character or action sequences or whatever. So, you know, there's those craft conversations, you know, about just understanding kind of the beast that you're writing. You know, and then the emotional
figuring out that a lot of times they figure out, oh, I don't even want to write an action movie. Now that you tell me all that, I don't even care about all that. What I care about is this, right? And then you're like, well, then that's not an action movie, right? Like that's a blind spot because you're like, well, I have to do an action movie because that's what sells.
Yes.
And so that's what you're writing, right? I mean, that's what I find often. Then you're like, you don't even really want to do an action movie or whatever.
Yeah, no, exactly. And a lot of the work that I do around blind spots and what you're talking about too is like going back to this question of like, why did you want to write this movie? Like, what was that moment? What was that spark? What was that moment where you got the idea and you were just flooded with all these kind of like imaginings, you know, in your brain? Because that helps you kind of get at the kind of movie you want to write, the emotions you felt when you thought about it. Even thematics, you know, like sometimes you get an idea and you're like, oh, this is about this, but it's really about this larger thing, you know? So it's going back to that stuff. But when I feel like someone has an emotional blind spot, you know, I'm not a therapist in any way, shape or form. But I will ask them, I will have them do exercises. Like I worked with one person who was really, had a blind spot like this, but was actually open to kind of exploring, you know, why they couldn't go there, you know? And so we ended up, I did an exercise where we started with, I had him write his character's biggest fear. And I encouraged him to go like really dark, like it's bad, paint the scene, write it out, give me details. What does it smell like? What does it taste like? What does it feel like? You know, and he wrote this really great, like two paragraphs of what his character's worst fear was. And then I said, okay, now I want you to write down your biggest fear. And he went there, he was willing to go there. And you guys, it was the same. It was the same. And that's why the end of act two in his movie didn't have the depth that it needed to, because he wasn't willing to acknowledge that it was about him, it was about his fear, you know, and the thing that it just scared the crap out of him. He didn't want to go there, you know, but once he was able to kind of see it on the page, I think he saw the value of it and he rewrote his second act and it was really good because he went there, you know.
I love that. I love how storytelling is a vehicle often to evolve ourselves to, because this thing is asking you, it's bugging you, like, pay attention to me, write my story. And yet part of your brain is like, no, I'll write part of it, but I'm not writing the whole kit and caboodle, right? That will kill us. And that, so it's so great to go to someone like you, Pat, who can help you just take the hand of that writer and say, like you did with that exercise, it's okay, right? You're not going to die. About when you're giving notes, and I'm trying to teach this to my 18-year-old as well, who's starting to write and give notes to his friends, which is, I think the most important thing is to ask questions versus come in and with prescriptive things, or, you know, of course, it's always good to say, I didn't understand this, or please, could you make this more clear or whatever. But if the questions still are, I didn't understand this, therefore what, why, how, that's still a question, because it is the storyteller's dream. And you may be mixing up the metaphors. You may be projecting your dream onto theirs and you're completely missing the boat, and you're going to send them off in a direction unintentionally that isn't their dream. So I always ask questions first. And the questions I ask are, I try to go immediately down into the deepest core story engine topics, shall we say, elements, pieces of the engine, because every note, in my opinion, and we've talked about this, are symptoms of a deeper disease. So, you know, especially in like a writer's group, you're going to get a lot of maybe talk notes, which are symptoms, and those questions, by asking them questions like, well, what is this about for you, right? Thematically, emotionally, you know, thematically, emotionally is the first element, core element of the story engine, which is, why do we care? What is the emotional, what are you emotionally trying to say through this character's journey and experience? You know, and I'm speaking specifically to features, and I'm very interested in Lorian's take on television and how this, you know, I do think TV shows episodes can have thematics. I think whole shows can have thematics as a show. You know, why, you might be asking a question, you know, sometimes, especially for an indie filmmaker, they have a question about the way, why human beings are the way they are, you know, look at Blue, and you know, his question about, can you live and not live when the trauma and the loss is so great? How do you live without feeling anything? And then he just does it over and over, smashing, you know, life in at her. That having that question is the hardest one to get, of course, into the conscious brain. But even if that writer can give you a bucket, it's about injustice, it's about what, where are we, right? That at least can get everybody else's notes coming towards kind of what they are, the arena that they're in, right? And from there, you could world building questions are important, but I think they're mostly important in terms of the character. They're just metaphors, right, for what's happening to the character. But do you understand the world? And I don't just mean sci-fi. I mean this character's view of the world. The world is a dangerous place. Their place in the world. How are we experiencing the world through a character? you know, a lot of the movies I've been watching for the Academy run is, a lot of them are slice of life. So that's a whole other bucket of fish, right? Like this is just experiencing life as this person experiences it. But there's some that there is a version of storytelling that is take multiple, you never ever get into anybody's emotional point of view. Like you just keep bouncing around. And they're intellectually interesting, but they're not emotional to me. I can forget about them other than maybe the beautiful visuals. I don't feel like they ultimately rise up. Even Don't Look Up, it's so emotional and you're so in that character's point of view, even though he's got a lot of characters, when he's in it so deeply that, and he's picked really the two to really spine it, right? So what is their world? How do they see the world? Get me in there. And the other elements are tone. So you could be asking genre questions. Again, world and tone are kind of last or just help orient you to what is it they want.
Can you give an example of changing how you talk about yourself? You talked about coaching. So like, what's an example of like not being really clear about your brand with somebody in a meeting and then how you change that to be very clear about who you are?
Well, I think understanding what your intentions are, right? Like, and what your convictions are. I think sometimes you have to dig deep. It's like I always say interviewing is like dating, right? Like, when you're unclear of the type of mate you want, then you date a lot of people, right? And like eventually you find the person that you want to focus on. But also, if you don't love yourself, if you don't know who you are, then it's going to be harder to find that person. It's the same as like a job. So if you're unclear, if you're a writer and you're like, I want to write for like a crime drama, but all of the work that you do, like all of your specs are rom-com, that's going to be really hard to get you placed. So sometimes there's a disconnect with the body of work that people are producing versus where they want to go. And there's a disconnect in the brand there. The other is owning your own destiny. I think that sometimes, because people are unclear, and I went through this, like after I left Sony, I was like, people are like, what do you want to do? And I was like, I don't know. And then that's not helpful because people want to hear what your thoughts of where you want to be placed, because it's not malicious intent. They're just too busy to figure out your own career path. That's your job. And I knew it was my job to do it. And I was all over the place. And it wasn't until I started taking meetings and getting and doing some real soul searching, then I realized what I really wanted to do. But it took a little bit to get there. And I think that's okay. And like, I think sometimes we're really hard on ourselves and like, we must know immediately. You know, I think it's good to explore. It's good, whether you're writing or you're a visual storyteller, exploring different things that inspire you, different themes, different subject matter, different styles. And eventually it's like when you're in art school, like you try all these things out and eventually you come into your own, but you have to come into your own in order to get placed. Otherwise people don't know where to place you. So that's where that conviction lies. And then it's sometimes with your wording too. Like it's like using, like flipping a few things, like instead of I feel this could be like this, saying I know this could be like this. You know what I mean? Again, it's about that conviction. So not teeter-tottering on the maybes, or maybe it could be this way, but this is how it should be.
It's so funny. I mean, it's not funny, but you're talking about active voice, right? Which is something we need to write with, right? She runs to the bank, not she is running to the bank, right? We want active. It's like, I'm running to the bank, not I'm going to run to the bank, right? So I remember I had a meeting with you, a general with you at Sony. And I said, it was first time I ever said this out loud. You asked me, what do you want to do? And I said, I'm a showrunner. I just don't have a show yet. And I said that out loud to you. And I was like, oh no, that's what it is. I am a showrunner. I just don't happen to have a show yet. Right. So then it was like, yeah, that's So it was, so you're magic. So thank you for that. But for me, that was a really powerful thing to own. It's really scary to say that stuff out loud too, right? Because when you say it out loud and you believe it, you're sort of hoping that other people believe it as well, right? But they will. You have to tell people who you are. So to your earlier point, they don't decide who you are.
Yeah. Just super quickly, just piggyback off that too, Lori. And like another writing lesson we can take away from this is, I think like that's such a sharp observation of active voice and just like a really clear distillation understanding of our wants. You know, it's the my biggest takeaway every week on this show is develop characters with agencies, develop characters with desires. And that's what we need to do in our own career as well. So I just had that thought.
I have all my clients create branding decks.
Ooh, what's that? Tell us about that.
So in it, they have to, because it's almost like it's part of manifestation, right? Or when you do like a Pinterest board or a vision board, anything like that, it's getting everything together in one spot. So they have to write their bio. And the way that I make them write their bio is, what makes your voice unique? It's about empowering perspective. In a world where everything is about diversity and inclusion, what is it about your backgrounds? What makes you unique? Why do we need to be hearing your stories or looking at your art? Like, where does that point of view come from? Give us a little bit of insider baseball into your world.
Can you give an example? Do you have
So one of the other managers, this is a story she tells, is she had a writer who she was putting up for jobs over at the CW. And she was, I think she ended up landing one, but there was then her client came to her and was like, oh, there's a bunch of these great witch projects. You know, I grew up Wiccan. And it was around the time that like Sabrina the Teenage Witch, and she's like, man, if you had told me that earlier, I could have probably got you on Sabrina. So it's like these little, like what we don't know as representatives, we don't know. And the more information you can tell us about your background and again, that unique perspective of things you've grown up with. Another one of my clients, his mom was part of the, like was in the Cambodian killing fields. And then his dad was in the army, and that's how he met his mother. And he's this ex-army brat. And so it's like, again, this really unique perspective of not, look, we all come from a place of trauma, and not that we need to glorify our trauma, but it is also what gives us our unique perspective. And so if you can not, you don't need to be a Debbie Downer in your bio, but it's about like showcasing these little tidbits and sprinkling and peppering that in to your bio, just to personalize it, to get somebody to connect that you're not just a number, you're not just another writer, you're not just another visual storyteller, but you're a human that has had these wonderful and scary and sometimes traumatic experiences. And I think people want people to be real. I think when people are looking for writers, they're looking for people to connect with the material. And it's just like interviewing for any job. Like some people are like, why didn't I get that job? I'm like, well, how into the company did you do the research? Like, why do you want to go for that job? And sometimes people are just going for it for the sake of going for something versus really being strategic and understanding why they're driven for that position. So that when they do eventually get that meeting, they're really able to talk about why they're so passionate about it. So I get my clients to talk about, if we're up for a job, why are we up for that job? Why are we excited? How can we make sure if we're doing a pitch back? Like I just had I have two female clients. They just got a directing gig over at Cartoon Network. And as they were doing the pitch back, I asked them to continue peppering in why this particular project is important to them. So throughout the whole time of the pitch back, it was this part was great, and this is why I responded to it. So it's about threading that narrative of you plus the content together.
Thanks for tuning in to The Screenwriting Life. We love our community and we want to get to know you even better. Join our Facebook group at facebook.com/thescreenwritinglife or email us at thescreenwritinglife@gmail.com to have your question considered for the show. You can also suggest topics by emailing us there. Also, we'd love for you to drop us a review on Apple Podcasts. Even if we don't read your review on air, trust me, we have read it, and not only does it mean the world to us, but it helps other people find the show. We've always been driven by mission and mentorship, and reviewing our show helps expand that mission. And of course, until next Sunday, happy writing.